Hello, welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or follow via the Facebook page, or subscribe at my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that Turkey Book Talk is now available on Acast, which is good news if that's where you get your podcasts. Let me also give another heads up for the newly opened Twitter account, which is waiting for more followers. The handle for that is @TurkeyBookTalk. Remember, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, making a small or large donation on a per episode basis. Find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. You can also help in another way by rating it or reviewing this podcast on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. The more people like it, the more other interested people who don't know about it will be able to find it themselves. But now let's get cracking with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Sabancı University Associate Professor Cenk Özbay and Galatasaray University lecturer Ayşecan Terzioğlu, the editors of a new collection of essays called The Making of Neoliberal Turkey, which is published by Ashgate. The book is a collection of 13 essays by a range of contributors on changes in Turkey since the 1980s. As in elsewhere in the world, Turkey went through a wrenching economic transformation during and after the 1980s, when its economy was opened up to global market forces. This process was obviously very turbulent and had many deep, intended and unintended consequences. The book explores the social effects of these changes from various surprising angles, including masculinity in satirical comics, laws to address violence in football, and the healthcare sector. I started by asking Cenk Özbay and Ayşecan Terzioğlu to summarise the trends that took hold in the aftermath of Turkey's military coup on September the 12th, 1980.
Everything started with the January 24th decisions undertaken by the Demirel government in 1980, which was followed by the coup within the same year. And then the military administration assigned Turgut Özal, who was the architect, the chief economist of the state back then, as the minister of the economy of the interim government, the military government. And in 1983, in the first free elections that Turkey had, he became the prime minister. His party won the election and he became the prime minister. And his agenda was clearly like neoliberal. He was integrating Turkish economy to global markets, global economy, certain deregulation he included in policies. Deunionization was very important for him. He always like used those like similar slogans, similar mottos with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, that like Turkey should catch up with the world. Turkey should integrate the global system. We need to like transform society. So like all those like similar ideas, privatization, deregulation, free entrepreneurship, all these ideas. And then during the 1990s, which Turkish scholars would call it the long decade to forget, right? Because of the like a series of governments who fail to undertake economic reforms and like social processes, social conflict became intense during 1990s. And then after an economic crisis came the current AKP government after a certain economic and social depression with the earthquake too. And since then, since 2001, we are living like in a neoliberalizing government, like a strong neoliberal government. Mm-hmm. However, with its own contradictions, like it's not a typical neoliberal government, and
Erdogan the state is quite strong.
Yes,
yeah,
it became stronger actually. That's during the so like this is kind of like a history of like ruptures and discontinuities, I guess briefly. Turkish neoliberalization process.
Yeah, and the book addresses these social and cultural aspects of this economic transformation in many different chapters that are very wide ranging. But, I mean, I guess this term neoliberalism, often when we see it, it's kind of a slippery term and many people who use it don't define what they mean by it. But a key point that you make in the book, that all the contributors make in the book, is that it doesn't necessarily mean a retreat of state power. Paradoxically, it means a kind of retrenchment of the state, an increase in state intervention in various parts of social life. Could you just explain that process?
I think, like, I can say, like, this point is really important to understand, like, Turkish case of neoliberalization. In a certain sense, the transformation the state has been subjected to is typical in terms of, like, the constitution of neoliberal principles and following neoliberal rules, privatization. And the state is leaving the individual, the citizen, alone in terms of many responsibilities that the state used to have. Mm-hmm. For example, welfare, for example, education, mm-hmm. for example, like retirement, right, unemployment. So in many cases, in many kind of like spheres of life, we see that the state, Turkish state, is typically neoliberal in the sense that its priority is on capital. It aims to serve the capital instead of taking care of its citizens. But on the other hand, there are certain areas that we can find that is quite atypical, right? The state, kind of like at the backstage, is gaining more and more power every day. And of course, this is the kind of, this is as an outcome of a political will. So the political will uses neoliberalism or neoliberalized Turkey in self-contradictory ways. I think this is more important to grasp for us in order to like better understand what's really going on in Turkey.
One of the interesting things that's mentioned throughout the book, even if it's just mentioned indirectly, it's implied, this idea that pre-1980, pre this huge transformation in the Turkish economy, Turkish politics revolved around a kind of traditional left-right meta-narrative, really. And it was in the aftermath of the economic reforms after 1980 when politics kind of became the area of cultural and lifestyle choices, and the economic questions were kind of placed almost beyond the realm of political debate. So you had this flourishing of religion in the political sphere. Also, there was the rise in nationalism, Turkish nationalism, and Kurdish nationalism. Could you just comment on this shift in the references in the political debate that were encouraged by these economic reforms?
Well, of course, like, it's not unique to Turkey. Like, it is a larger trend in, like, starting with late 1970s, that Marxist-based, like, class analysis and class-based social mobilities and politics,
black unions,
declined. Yeah. And with the new reforms in economy and the integrated world economy, which we now turn back and call neoliberalism, the emergence of neoliberalism, identity politics have risen. So, like, in Turkey, last week, I was discussing with my students at Sabancı University that now everybody is criticizing CHP, the Republican People's yeah. Party, that it doesn't get votes from the working classes, although mm-hmm. it's supposed to be a leftist party.
It became more elitist and late
party. But the point is, like, it's not the politics anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So now neoliberalism is inevitable. It is so normal. It's so natural that anybody can challenge it. Therefore, the economic inequalities or the class-based analysis is taken for granted. People are looking for their identities, religious politics, against secularist republicanism in Turkey. So not only religious identities are a result of cultural politics, but also the secularist, laicite, became a political issue, especially after the 1980s. And as you said, like, Turkish and Kurdish nationalism together have risen. And in addition to that, in the book we talk about it a lot, there are also smaller sections of identity politics and people who came together in social groups that are not necessarily translated into party politics. But for example, feminists, LGBT activists, environmentalists. Mm-hmm. Right now in the city, for example, vegetarian people, mm-hmm. those are like small circles, cultural circles,
yeah.
have or have not political demands mm-hmm. from the conventional parties, mm-hmm. but they all got a sense of like voice, I guess, in the political mm-hmm. arena which is not the case in 1970s, I guess.
Sure, it became more, I mean, all these voices and identities became more multiple and more micro, maybe, and also more and more negotiated on a daily basis. And I think it's all related with this political imagery and also ideology, like also the how the ideology and a particular ideology binds or doesn't bind all of us. Like at the beginning of Turkish Republic, it was all about, you know, saying that you're Turkish, or, you know, they wanted to create a certain kind of Turkish Sunni Muslim but secular identity. And, you know, that came with certain oppressions or certain limitations that some people, you know, some ethnic or religious groups didn't belong there. And that is why most of the people, like journalists and academics, read the 1980s as a return of the oppressed. But right now, I think the dynamics are even more different than that, because the oppressed became more vocal, and, you know, it's, you know, that kind of paradigm became kind of obsolete, you know, in 2000s, I believe, because right now there are all these different groups trying to be more visible and vocal in the society and try to come up with different, you know, or alternative ways of living or ways of defining identity.
This book was designed in 2013.
13 and 14, 13, yeah. Especially. It took a long time to write.
Yeah, publish. Yeah. But right now, today, probably we would look at like how precarious Turkish society is. Mm-hmm. Not individuals only, but this is a precarious life.
And randomness, maybe. Anything can happen anytime type of thing, both politically and in the social life. So, you know, in terms of, you know, all these events taking place and so on. So that kind of precarity, and although maybe unrest as well, you know, which kind of shapes our daily life.
Yeah, I've just written a review of 2016, like basically from January to December. And it's just, you know, it's so difficult to put everything
in.
It's
a difficult task.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And but just going back to this question of the social effects, it always strikes me that there's a kind of paradox at work. I wrote an article last year on how LGBT activist groups in Turkey have really proliferated in recent years, but at the same time, there's been this very public rise in official conservatism, religious-inspired conservatism, in line with the strength of the government. So there seems to be a kind of double movement going on, in a way, in Turkish society, where some parts are becoming more liberal and more open, and groups are becoming more vocal, whereas other parts of society are heading in the other direction at the same time. And probably both of these things are influencing each other. And that's part of where a lot of the tension, I think, comes from in Turkish society. Like both things have been unleashed and they're probably uncontrollable. And that's where a lot of the kind of tension comes from.
I agree with you. I think like you caught a great case, but with LGBT activists and rights, because it's kind of like it is where the larger question became crystallized in terms of like a duality within Turkish society between people who are more open to, let's say, global currents and to the rest of the world, whereas a growing majority that is becoming more and more insular, mm-hmm. right, closed off from the rest of the world. I don't know where will it go, which direction will it take. It's, again, as what you said, like the unpredictability of what is going on with this society. But this tension, everyday tension, and the kind of like discontinuity of social relations between different segments of people seems like unsustainable. The state, in this kind of like polarization, is not neutral, right? The state on the side of the growing majority who become like more insular
and conservative, and religious,
yes, and seeing the rest of the world not as like an ally but with hostility, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the question of being more open to the rest of the world or close, or which part of the rest of the world. You know, there are all these, you know, kind of stupid, silly debates about getting the Western technology, but not the Western lifestyle or morality. But, you know, there you cannot never do such a social engineering. You know, those things are always a kind of, you know, ideological, you know, mottos, which don't work really in everyday life. And, you know, maybe I want to add certain things that Cenk said, which I totally agree. And, you know, with this conservative approach, always have really clear gender norms and gender codes, like women should give birth. And, you know, just like in Marla Arel's article, you know, after menopause, you know, menopause should be a sickness, it should be treated, and they can do this and they cannot do that, you know. Certain things are imposed, you know, in women's reproductive abilities, like, you know, banning of cesarean, you know, things about abortion and so on. So many feminist and LGBT groups as well are fighting against these limitations or government's discourses and practices, which kind of enforces those gender codes and norms. So that is one of the other types of polarization. So there are several polarizations which we can maybe, you know, summarize into those two groups. So those who want to be more liberal, like socially, culturally more liberal and transnational or international, or those who want to be more insular.
There's something else I want to address as well that I think doesn't often get mentioned. It's this idea that there's been a kind of gradual cultural, political domination, really, of an extension of the government's power over the last few years. But it seems like there's one area, a very crucial area, that still hasn't been conquered, really, which is economically. And, you know, still there's this big divide between, you know, the government supporters, who are generally poorer, and the opposition, who are generally of the middle and upper class. And people don't talk about it in these terms, but I wonder if part of the reason why the government's getting so angry is because there's still this divide, and there's almost a subconscious kind of reaction to this sense of, I don't want to use the word inadequacy, but this kind of almost sense of resentment that there's still this kind of division, that they're still looked down upon by the opposition in a kind of very sophisticated way that can't really be put into words, but everybody understands what it means. Do you think that has anything to it?
I think it must like have anything to do with it. But first, I want to oppose you by saying that the supporters of the government have their own social classes, which probably like emerged in the last 15 years. So maybe we should talk about, like, we can say that the former middle and upper classes.
Or maybe secular, secular middle and upper classes, because right now the...
In the past, they were all secular.
That's true, yeah, in the past.
So before the year 2000, let's say, the middle and upper class meant being secular.
That's true, but they...
Kind of like enlightened, modern, educated kind of thing. But more interesting than that is the, like, rise of the government supporter middle and upper classes, which you can find them in certain locations in the consumption economy, in certain shopping malls in Istanbul, and obviously their choices and their taste is slightly different than the, like, other classes that we used to know better.
That's true. Yeah.
And more important than that, I'm a sociologist, so I'm looking at how masses of people are divided based on that question of judgment. One phenomena in social media that I could follow is Chomar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The university students, college students, high school students of the formerly educated Western type call the government supporters Chomar.
It's very condescending. It's basically a dog's name or
William,
dog
William,
type.
William, are you familiar with this? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a street dog, Chomar.
Street dog, yeah.
You know,
this is a new thing as well. It's not been, I can't remember it like 5 years ago, people using this word, but maybe I'm wrong.
Quite recent.
Maybe 1 or 2 years at most.
And I think this kind of, like, of course, this is so, like, it's so rude to call somebody
of course,
like this.
So condescending,
yeah. When I look at the societal level of how this kind of like differentiation, and this is not necessarily based on political views. This is not based necessarily on how much money you make, but it's about a question of taste. It's kind of like deep-rooted cultural values in terms of cultural judgment.
That's true. And remember that there was always this vein of secularism, westernization from the Ottoman Empire onwards since the 19th century. So there was a strong elite of like 5-6 generations, having the best occupations, best housing, and so on. So, you know, with high class and status. So there were some reactions against this new class and status groups, you know, which are completely different from the old elites. So there is a kind of tension, you know, in that as well.
Oh, so you mean like the relation between the old elites and the new elites is not new, but it was there before.
Maybe it increased because there's a new, you know, more religious, and so, and also they gained power, like more political and economic power, and they are more visible in the cities and so on with the urbanization.
But I want to add that, like, in addition to that level of power struggle between these two different classes, there is something more going on at the everyday level.
Sure, right? Like societal taste, like, and so on, cultural balance.
Conventional universities doesn't accept us, doesn't accept our views, so we're gonna like start new universities.
Of course, yeah.
Brand new universities out of scratch, or
publishing companies, restaurants. Yeah.
Like your taste in clothing, for example, doesn't apply to us, so we are gonna like constitute our new taste level.
Of course, totally.
But as William was asking, like they are, the government side is still angry. Because of their ideas, their taste level is not accepted.
Yeah.
So the resentment originating from that point, which
That's the source of anger.
Is a sharp observation.
It's good, it's a good one,
That was Cenk Özbay and Ayşecan Terzioğlu. We were discussing the book The Making of Neoliberal Turkey, which they co-edited with Maral Erol and Umut Turem, and which is published by Ashgate. You can read my review of the book at the Hürriyet Daily News, and on my WordPress website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, I've also posted a link to the article that I mentioned earlier in the conversation, in which I spoke to members of AK-LGBT, a group of LGBT supporters of Erdogan and the AKP, who are an interesting group of people. Remember, rate or review the Turkey Book Talk podcast on iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher, or Acast, if you haven't already. There's also the Facebook page, and don't forget to follow the new Twitter account to stay updated with new episodes via @TurkeyBookTalk. Email me with feedback, recommendations, or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, remember, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to help me keep it going, you can support it via my Patreon account, donating on a per-episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. This is the last episode of 2016. Thank you to everyone who's listened over the course of the year. That's 22 episodes in total. Needless to say, without you listeners out there, I wouldn't be putting this podcast together. But until the new year, and no doubt many new episodes, thank you very much once again for listening.